Welcome to our second season of Stratford Mail, a smart little history podcast from Stratford Hall Historic Preserve, where the voices of American history still speak. Find us online at stratfordmail.org and at stratfordhall.org. We're so glad you're back, and we hope you'll share Stratford Mail with a friend or colleague. Here now is our Director of Research, Dr. Gordon Blaine Steffi.
Welcome back, listeners. This month, you're in occupied Philadelphia and up to your ears in the politics of big hair. In June 1778, British troops under the command of General Sir Henry Clinton ended their 8-month occupation of Philadelphia. Convening in exile at York, Pennsylvania, the Continental Congress resolved to reconvene at the Capitol on July 2nd, and they appointed a 3-man committee to plan
a public celebration of the anniversary of independence at Philadelphia.
The public celebration opened with a parade, and fireworks flowered in the night sky above crowded streets to conclude the festivity. In the afternoon, 80-odd congressional and municipal VIPs tucked into a modest banquet at City Tavern, where William Ellery of Rhode Island was favorably impressed by a large baked pudding staked with a crimson flag depicting the providential triumph of liberty over oppression. Ellery was also witness to an extraordinary unofficial procession.
In the afternoon, a strumpet with a headdress, an imitation of those worn by the Tory ladies while the British army held the city, was paraded through the streets, attended by a crowd of the vulgar. What a strange vicissitude in human affairs. These colonies are now free, sovereign, and independent states, and now celebrate the anniversary of their independence in the very city where, but a day or two before, General Howe exhibited his ridiculous champêtre.
Never you fear, we will circle back to that strumpet, which is 18th century vernacular for a female prostitute. Of more immediate interest is the contrast Ellery draws between independence celebrations and the ridiculous champêtre of General Sir William Howe. Now, Howe was commander-in-chief of British land forces occupying Philadelphia from September 1777 until his resignation in April of 78. Before Howe returned, somewhat ingloriously, to Britain, where he was unpopular due to his perceived mismanagement of the war, his officers funded a gaudy farewell bash in Howe's honor. Ellery calls it a ridiculous outdoor festival, a champêtre. In point of fact, it was called the Meschianza. Meschianza improvises on several Italian words meaning medley, mingling, and mix. A reference to the set of extravagant entertainments orchestrated for the departing Howe. The mastermind behind this incredible 14-hour blowout called Meschianza was Captain John Andre, later and better known as the British spy master executed for his role in a failed conspiracy with Benedict Arnold to surrender West Point to the British. In occupied Philadelphia, Andre relished his role as event planner, publishing a full account of his Meschianza in Gentleman's Magazine No. 48 for 1778. In explanation of this Meschianza, Andre pointed to the troops' admiration for General Howe.
I do not believe there is upon record an instance of a commander-in-chief having so universally endeared himself to those under his command, or of one who receives such signal and flattering proofs of their love.
One such proof of love for Howe were the elaborately engraved tickets to the Meschianza's 400-odd guests, which carried the Latin inscription,
I shine in setting, I shall rise again in greater splendor.
In point of fact, Howe's light was ever after timid and flat. But on May 18th of 1778, John Andre made William Howe the luminous center of British North America. The Meschianza opened around 4 p.m. with a ceremonial regatta, a flotilla of colorfully festooned barges floating down the Delaware River to artillery salutes fired from the anchored warships HMS Roebuck and Vigilant. The flotilla landed near Old Swedes Episcopal Church, and the revelers processed with musical accompaniment to Walnut Grove, the South Philadelphia estate of the late Joseph Wharton. There, a tourney ground edged by tiered pavilions had been set up for a joust. You heard right, a joust with hardwood lance and shield. Two make-believe orders of knights, complete with their own heraldry, would compete in mock combat for the honor of corresponding orders of fair damsels. The damsels were young women picked from elite loyalist and non-aligned Philadelphia families, among them Becky Franks, Peggy and Sarah Chu, Jane Craig, and Wilhelmina Smith. In this masquerade, British officers costumed as knights of the Bourbon court minus the armor, exchanged blows as proof of love for young American women costumed as turbaned Ottoman maidens. Now, suffice it to say that neither the Bourbons nor the Ottomans were authentically represented in this British fever dream. Speaking of the orientalized coif she wore to the event, participant Jane Craig reflected that it was
more towering than the drawing.
She means André's drawing, which survives to this day. André designed the participant's wardrobe and is the source of its unsubtle messaging. And what was the message? The impeccably chivalrous Imperial British lovers simultaneously vanquish the resistance of these exotic American inferiors and liberate them from their unchivalrous American sultans. With the war thus relocated to a fantasy realm, guests retired indoors for a magnificent ball punctuated by fireworks and midnight banqueting. Producing his own event press, André wrote that guests
danced and drank till daylight,
departing highly pleased with
the most splendid entertainment ever given by an army to their general.
Not everyone shared André's assessment of the Maschianza. Ambrose Searle, private secretary to Admiral Lord Richard Howe, the honoree's brother, whispered to his diary that André's Maschianza was
folly and extravagance,
and that
every man of sense among ourselves, though not unwilling to pay a due respect, was ashamed of this mode of doing it.
Nor did loyalist Philadelphian Joseph Galloway mince his words.
We have seen the same general with a vanity and presumption unparalleled in history. After this indolence, after all these wretched blunders, except from a few of his officers, a triumph more magnificent than would have become the conqueror of America without the consent of his sovereign or approbation of his country, and that at a time when the news of war with France had just arrived, and in the very city, the capital of North America, the late seat of Congress, which in a few days was to be delivered up to that Congress.
And Philadelphian Quaker Elizabeth Drinker complained to her diary.
This day may be remembered by many from the scenes of folly and vanity promoted by the officers of the army under pretext of showing respect to General Howe. How insensible do these people appear? While our land is so greatly desolated, and death and sore destruction has overtaken and impends over so many.
But perhaps incongruity was the point. That in the face of sore destruction and wavering confidence in the outcome of this war, British occupiers fled temporarily to fantasy, to romance, to a Camelot where bloodless contests between virtuous men overcome contrary inferiors and resolve harmoniously into feasting and dance. It's difficult to evade the suggestion that André's spectacle was an attempt to annihilate reality, but reality is rude. And it reasserted itself a few days later when the order to end the occupation and to withdraw from Philadelphia was announced. The next day, Ambrose Searle wrote in his diary,
I now look upon the contest as at an end.
And by June 19th, Elizabeth Drinker observed,
The English have in reality left us.
Cannon fire welcomed the return of the Continental Congress to Philadelphia on July 2nd, and Independence Day festivities were, as I've described, austere and muted by contrast to the Maschianza, and even by contrast to Independence Day's past. This was perhaps to acknowledge the sore destruction lamented by Elizabeth Drinker and to spare the material stores of wartime Philadelphia. And yet the streets of Philadelphia did not let the opportunity pass both to celebrate the day and to take a poke at Philadelphians whose commitment to the Patriot cause was as uncertain as their hair was outsized. And now we circle back, as promised, to that prostitute spotted in procession by William Ellery and sporting the big hair associated with the Tory ladies. Ellery wasn't the only one to catch a glimpse. Richard Henry Lee of Stratford and Chantilly was another witness to this curious procession reported by Ellery. And in a letter dated July 5th, 1778 from Philadelphia, Richard Henry updates his brother Frank, that's Francis Lightfoot Lee, at his Richmond County home, Monocan.
My dear brother, we had a magnificent celebration of the anniversary of independence yesterday, when handsome fireworks were displayed. The wigs of the city dressed up a woman of the town, with the monstrous headdress of the Tory ladies, and escorted her through the town with a great concourse of people. Her head was elegantly and expensively dressed, I suppose about 3 feet high and of proportionable width, with a profusion of curls, etc. The figure was droll and occasioned much mirth. It has lessened some heads already, and will probably bring the rest within the bounds of reason, for they are monstrous indeed. The Tory wife of Dr. Smith has christened this figure Continella, or the Duchess of Independence, and prayed for a pin from her head by way of relic. The Tory women are very much mortified, notwithstanding this.
The monstrous headdress of the Tory ladies refers to the heavy, elaborate, and soaring hairstyle called the high roll, adapted from France by fashion-setting peers of Georgian London and transplanted to the colonies. The height of the high roll was constructed using pillows, wool pads, wire frames, additional hair from human, sometimes deceased human, and animal sources, and lavish amounts of scented pomade for shaping the do upwards. It was then stabilized with pins and embellished with ribbons, feathers, fabrics, wax fruit, wooden totems, and sundry other objects. The coif took hours to perfect, and once erected, transmitted the message that here was a woman of quality. It was nevertheless difficult to square the high-rolled American lady, invariably an avid consumer of British imports, with the austere daughter of liberty, whose low hair and homespun attire expressed values prized by Whig patriots like simplicity and self-sufficiency. The high-roll came under fire on both sides of the Atlantic. On the British side, printers represented the high roll in much the same terms Ambrose Searle used to describe the mezquianza as
folly and extravagance,
which is how the British might also have described the ongoing American insurgency. On the American side, the high roll carried the nuance of dependence, perhaps of being dictated to culturally in the same way that John Andre had literally dictated their mezquianza wardrobe to the daughters of Philadelphia. As Noah Webster, famed for his dictionary, put it in 1789,
"As an independent nation, our honor requires us to have a system of our own, in language as well as government."
And we might add, in coiffure or hairstyles. Yes, the high roll was a clue, not quite a smoking gun, to mixed-up priorities and uncertain loyalties, and it came to signify for some betrayal of the most intimate sort. A mezzotint circulating under the title The Wishing Females captured the moment. It depicted two high-rolled women, one equipped with a handheld telescope, gazing through their parlor window at British troops mustering in a staging area. The subtext of sexual desire was stark, and seemed to express the same anxiety voiced by Josiah Bartlett of New Hampshire in an August 1778 letter to his wife. There, Bartlett remarks that when Congress returned to Philadelphia, they
found the Tory ladies who tarried with the regulars wearing the most enormous high headdresses, after the manner of the mistresses and whores of the British officers.
Parading an absurdly high-rolled prostitute through the streets was a dire editorial on the values of the Philadelphia high-rollers. One variant on the tale sharpened the barb by racializing it, by making the woman black. Another by making her a hem. In any case, the Tory wife of Dr. Smith, that's Rebecca Moore Smith, mother to Willie Smith, one of the faux Ottoman maidens at the mezquianza, attempted to deflect the takedown by naming the high-rolled prostitute Contanella, Duchess of Independence, and thus making her the poster girl for low-born upstarts with pretensions to equality with their betters. But her deflection fizzled, and Richard Henry reports the parade induced some high-rollers to repent of their skyscraping coifs, and it may be that this unofficial street theater prompted an abatement of lofty high-rolls, but big hair didn't deflate overnight. And between 1778 and 2024, it would make its mark on several decades. And hairstyle remains today a contested ground where different social, cultural, and political views vie for dominance and recognition. That Richard Henry Lee took note of this droll figure on parade is unsurprising, given his own personal dalliance with street theater in the prior decade. But that is a story for another day. From Stratford Hall Historic Preserve in Westmoreland County, Virginia, I'm Director of Research Dr. Gordon Blaine Steffi. Please check out our new website at stratfordmail.org, and don't forget to follow us on your favorite platform.
Dear listeners, wouldn't you like to do more than just listen, sponsor an episode or more of Stratford Mail by getting in touch with us at arthurlee@stratfordmail.org? Once more, that's arthurlee@stratfordmail.org. And please don't forget to follow Stratford Mail and share it with someone you love, someone you know. We promise not to disappoint you.